This is episode number 300 with Jesse Itzler.
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
Welcome everyone to this episode, a very special milestone. That's right, we hit 300 episodes on the School of Greatness. Now, we have been around for just over 3 years. We have over 15 million downloads, and we're at 300 episodes. I am just in awe and amazed as I reflect back on the idea for the School of Greatness in the first place. The reason the School of Greatness came about was because I was at a turning point in my life. I was at kind of a lower moment, a lot of frustration, some anxiety, some resentment I was feeling. And I had just moved to LA from New York City, and I was going through a breakup. And I remember just feeling like, what am I going to do next with my life? What's next for me? And I was talking to some friends who were podcasting already, who were having success with it. I was stuck in LA traffic every day, kind of a little bit angry and frustrated that I wasn't in New York anymore. And I just said, you know what? There's got to be a way to share these insights from brilliant minds that I'm spending time with on a daily basis with the rest of the world. There's got to be a way to tap into their mind, into their heart and their soul, and access some of the wealth of this information that they have, and then really break it down in a way so everyone can consume it, understand it, and apply it to their lives to become their greatest self. And that's how it began, again, just over 3 years ago. So I want to say thank you so much for listening. For if this is your first time or your 300th episode that you've listened to, thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing this out with your friends. You know, the way that we continue to grow is by you spreading the word, by you posting it on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and emailing your friends and just talking about it, saying, hey, guys, have you heard of the School of Greatness podcast? Check out this cool episode. I think you'd really enjoy it. That's how people get on board, and that's how the movement began and how it continues to grow with over 1 million downloads a month. So I just want to say thank you and acknowledge all of you for joining me on this journey over 3 years in, 300 episodes, and I'm excited to continue going to the next level for this show. So there's no point anytime soon where I see myself slowing down. It's only getting bigger, better, and it's all for you guys. So I hope you guys are enjoying it. Again, thank you for being here, and I'm so pumped for this interview and this episode because it's with my new friend, Jesse Itzler. Now, for those that don't know who Jesse is, extremely impressive human being, an incredible entrepreneur. He is the original partner of Zico Coconut Water, which is coconut water I used to drink all the time and still do. He's also a co-founder of Marquee Jets. He's an Emmy Award winner and a best-selling rapper, and also the co-owner of the Atlanta Hawks NBA basketball team. And he felt the need to break out of his day-to-day routine. You know, here's a guy who has achieved incredible success in his life, and he felt the need to break out of his day-to-day routine and grow beyond his perceived limitations and discover possibilities within himself he never knew he had. So he decided to have a Navy SEAL, one of the top Navy SEALs in the world, really, move to his New York City penthouse suite alongside his family. His wife, by the way, is a Forbes top self-made woman in America. Her name is Sarah Blakely, who's the founder and CEO of the billion-dollar company Spanx. So he had this Navy SEAL move in, and a lot opened up for him during this month with this extreme Navy SEAL training him every single day. And a lot of the lessons we're going to talk about, covering how much and how often that you should switch up your habits and routines. Now, you guys know I talk about habits and routines all the time, and Jesse has an interesting point about habits and routines that can get people caught up in the mundane as well. Also, why Jesse needed a big push to go to the next level, even though he was already crushing it. How to take back control of your time. If you feel overwhelmed, if you feel stressed, if you feel distracted, here's how to take back control of your time. What Jesse does to make time for himself, with all the kids, with all the businesses, with all the people that are constantly coming after him, he spends more time with himself than anyone else I know, and why breaking a habit is so hard and how to get through it. We cover those ideas and principles and so much more in this episode. I hope you guys enjoy this one. Make sure to head back to lewishouse.com/300 to watch the full video interview. Check out the book that he just came out about this story and all the show notes we cover in today's episode. And without further ado, let me introduce you to the one, the only, Jesse Itzler. Welcome back, everyone, to the School of Greatness podcast. Very excited about this. Our guest is Jesse Itzler. Thanks for coming in, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
pleasure.
I'm pumped for this. I saw this come out. This is the first time I heard about you when this book came out. And I remember being talked about. I think maybe your publicist sent me the information or someone did it. Ed O'Keefe, a buddy of mine, had you on, I don't think, his podcast and told me about you. And I was like,
yeah,
who is this guy? Who's this SEAL guy? I don't know what's happening. But then I started doing more research on you and I was like, oh, I actually want to meet this guy. So I'm excited that you're here. I'm excited. I don't think we've had anyone on here who is like you. So I think it'll be interesting to kind of uncover the things that you've created, what you've done in your life. And you started out, from my research, as a rapper. Am I right?
I did.
Okay. So why were you inspired to be in the music space? Was that always something you loved to do as a child?
Or? Yeah. You know, I grew up in the 80s in New York City in Long Island. Which was a focal point for rap when it was starting out. So I just got, at an early age, had a real interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in college, I made a demo tape. And like most people trying to get into the music business in college or in the late 80s, I sent that about 100 cassettes. At the time, it was cassettes.
Right.
To A&R executives, to, you know, presidents of labels. I called everybody. And I got zero.
Nothing.
Nothing. Callback.
And so when was this? What year is this?
That was in 90, right?
Wow.
When all my college friends were doing resumes and I was sending out cassettes.
Wow.
And that was my first real experience with like pure, full out rejection.
Okay. You didn't get rejected before then?
Not 100 times in a row.
Right.
And, but it forced me to start to think differently and figure out that, you know what? You really got to kind of differentiate yourself and separate yourself to get noticed and get things done.
Right.
Which was ended up being a really valuable lesson for me down the road.
Sure, sure. So how did you start to break into the music world?
So I was in a recording studio in Corona, Queens, where I was recording at 2 a.m. I would ride my bike 20 miles from Long Island to the studio at the only time I could get studio time, which was 2 a.m.
Wow.
And the artist that was finished recording before me was a guy named Dana Dane, who was a big, you know, Brooklyn-based, huge rapper in the 80s, and on the mixing board was an advanced cassette of his second album that no one had that he left behind. So I literally, quote-unquote, borrowed the cassette. I was a fan of his, and I wanted to hear it.
Wow.
I took the cassette home, and I flew out to L.A. a week later to visit a friend, and on the plane ride out to L.A., I read that there was a label out here called Delicious Vinyl. It was probably the biggest independent rap label at the time. They had two artists. Young MC, who wrote Busta Move, and Tone Loc, who had Wild Thing. And I read that the founder of the company, or one of the founders, was a huge Dana Dane fan. And I had this guy's cassette. So when I landed...
Pre-released cassette.
Pre-released.
No one had heard it.
No one heard it. Impossible okay. to get. Like, go to jail if you have it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I cold called the label. And through a little bit of New York hustle and confusion, the secretary who took the call put me on hold. I explained that I had this cassette. I was dropping it off for Mike Ross, the founder.
Wow.
She came back and she said, Dana, Mike would like to see you at 2 o'clock. She thought I was Dana Dane. So I said, I'll be there at 2.
Wow.
And I got the meeting under the guise that they thought that it was Dana. So I got
wait, and you had his tape. Did he know you had his tape?
No, I never met him.
You took
in
it
my life.
To LA.
Took it to LA to listen to it myself.
Did he have an extra copy or was this just his only copy?
I have no idea.
Were you thinking to myself, what if this is his only copy or what happens if I don't bring it back or what if he's looking for it?
I wasn't thinking anything other than
care.
I really wanted to hear
oh
it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That took balls.
Yeah. So I got buzzed into this office. They said, Dana, come on in. Mike will be right with you. Escorted into his office with all these platinum records on the wall. And Mike came in and said, who are you? And I said, Dana's 20 minutes behind. I have his, you know, he's coming to see you, da-da-da-da. But while we wait, can I play my demo? Mm. He said, sure. And I told him I work with Dana, all the same studio. More confusion. And I put my cassette in and got a record deal.
Wow. Interesting. So through association of someone else credible, you essentially use that as social proof, it sounds like, and built your case up in person.
Yeah.
Amazing, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Wow. Okay, cool. And so from there, what happened? Was it just a big hit right away? Were you, you know, in the top charts with every song you had, or was it a struggle after that?
Well, I thought, 22 years old, 21 years old, that, you know, they had these great mega artists that all I had to do was sign the deal, uh-huh. and whatever I put out would be huge. A hit. But, you know, as you know, it doesn't work that way.
Exactly.
And that was another quick lesson that, uh-huh. you know, you really have to do it yourself. The label was so busy with other stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, that I really had to – I realized that I should have done more on myself. And it didn't go as I thought it would go. And I didn't get picked up for a second album.
Mm.
And, you know –
Do you know how many sales it did or
– Not enough to get picked up.
Okay, gotcha.
Whatever that number was, it wasn't enough. And, you know, I really – I had nothing on my resume other than I was a kiddie pool attendant that summer that I was riding my bike to the studio. So now I have no record deal, and the only thing I put on my resume is kiddie pool attendant and failed rapper, and that wouldn't really do it. So, you know, sometimes when you look at something that's a failure, it's sort of just life's way of tapping you on the shoulder mm-hmm. and saying you're off course.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was in the right world, but just a little bit off course.
Right,
and if
right.
I called an audible, but stayed in the, and I ended up doing jingles. And that
I read that, yeah. For like NBA teams.
I started doing theme songs for professional sports teams.
Amazing.
Which was a niche that sports music that didn't exist. Oh. Really created this category of sports music.
Which can be profitable. Jingles can be profitable, right?
Yeah. I mean, not for me.
Okay.
For most people, they were.
Sure.
The first song that I did was a song for the Knicks called Go New York Go in 92. And it was a theme song for the Knicks. They paid me $4,000. And it became the number one song on New York radio. It was a huge hit. But by the time I paid the singer, the studio, the engineer, the mix, all the things.
You were negative money.
Lost
yeah,
$400.
Yeah.
And but every team that came to Madison Square Garden would say, how do we get a song like that? And I realized, well, hold on, $4,000 times
50,
100 professional yeah. sports teams. I can that'll work.
Bad.
I'm not making anything now. And I started doing that. That was my little thing. And
amazing.
I did about 20 or 30 of them and came up with the concept. The songs became really in demand. There was no way to get them. They were played on radio. So if you were a Knick fan and you wanted the song, you couldn't get it.
Mm.
So my partner and I came up with an idea to sell this song, with all the other songs they play in the arena with great moments in team history in between it, like a musical program. And we sold a shitload. Can I curse on this?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah,
we sold a shitload of records.
That's great.
And that was my first kind of taste of having a little bit of loot.
Mm.
And after
91, 92.
93, when Jordan came back, we did a song for the Bulls called Right Back In It. When Michael came back, sold 500,000 Bulls CDs,
oh my gosh.
Which was a couple million dollars. And then took all the money, and which was probably the hardest thing I ever did in my life. Took all the money, and instead of going to buy a car or a house, which is what I wanted to do, we reinvested it in exclusive deals with all the sports leagues to do these team-specific compilations, and then sold the company to a public company.
Wow. So that did really well financially when you did all that? That's amazing.
Yeah, that was it.
Congrats.
That was a good little
– Most people don't think about reinvesting it back in their brand or their business or things like that. When I'm heavily doing that myself, I'm like the money I make, you know, I have a $4,000 car that I've had for years that I just like don't care about the
right.
possessions. I'm like, I'd rather build something meaningful that's impacting the world and also creating something cool at the same time. So it sounds like you learned a lot of amazing lessons.
Yeah. And it's very difficult if you don't have any investors and anyone,
yes.
you know, anyone to report to. And all of a sudden you have money in your bank account as a business.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take it out.
Yeah.
You don't think that you're going to have to reinvest it or
yep.
use it, especially when you're 22 years old.
Right.
You know, so that was a really tough thing. And, but it ended up being a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, up until then you had learned a lot of great lessons. What I'm hearing is the theme. And I'm curious, who was the most influential person in your life growing up, and what was the biggest lesson they taught you?
Well, it would certainly be my dad without question. But the best lesson I got was from my mom.
Mm.
When I went to college, my mom told me just to do everything I could, to try everything at school. Like nothing was off limits. Go to every lecture, do every intramural sport, go to every fraternity party, do everything. Meet as many people
uh-huh.
and just figure out what it is that you like to do. Now,
right.
I still don't know what I want to do or what I like to do. But it did give me a a different view, to just expose me to a whole different world that I didn't see growing up in Long Island. And that ended up being a really good lesson for me. But my parents have both been great influences on me.
What would you say is the biggest lesson your dad taught you?
He just gave me so much freedom to try to do whatever I wanted to do. And like, you know, I think he really supported my failures, and I had plenty, you know, and congratulated me on the attempt rather than the outcome.
Interesting. Okay. But at some point, you got to make money. So if you keep attempting something and you never make money, you've got to figure out a solution, right? Or
well, you don't have to make money if you're happy.
That's true. That's true.
But yeah.
Right. Well, if you're starting a business, you can't just fail over and over.
Right.
You got to eventually be profitable, I would say.
You do.
Pay your overhead, pay your employees.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Gotcha. That's cool, though. He gave you that freedom, that courage.
But the relationship between you and money is an important dynamic.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Very cool. So what happened after the music success? You know, you're reinvested in and you sold the company. Did you stay in the music world? Did you branch out?
Well, we sold the company to a public company.
Yep.
And the owner of the public company, a guy named Bob Silliman at SFX, had a private jet and invited my partner and I on a trip. We were the youngest company that he bought, as far as we were 25 or 26 years old when we sold the company. And he took a liking to us, kind of like young guys, invited us on a trip and went on a private jet. And as soon as we got on the plane, we kind of looked at each other and like, how in the world do we do this more often? Like, how do we get this?
Right.
And ultimately, that one trip led to a private jet business that we started called Marquee Jet.
Unbelievable. I think I went to a Marquee Jet party at a Super Bowl, in the Tampa Bay Super Bowl.
Yeah.
There was a party there. It was Marquee Jets. I think it was like – I'm not sure when this was.
Oh, I remember exactly.
5, 6 years ago maybe?
More. It was
7 years ago?
Yeah.
2009
more,
maybe?
Even maybe more. But yeah.
I think it was 2009
was it
maybe.
9?
When did you guys launch Marquee Jets?
01.
01. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I remember that and being like, wow, this is a pretty sweet party.
Yeah, that was like our annual.
That was cool. Yeah.
It was really cool.
Amazing. So you just decided that you're going to launch a jet company.
Well, we had the idea because we wanted to use it.
Right.
So we're like, you know what? Even if no one else signs up for this thing and we can fly on a private jet, that would be a win. But
it's a completely different skill set and business and industry that you didn't have any experience in, I'm assuming, right?
I mean, that's kind of a theme for me. I mean, I think one of the things is I look back on my life and I was in music, I was in private jets, I've been in coconut water and all
sports.
These different things, sports, is that I had no prior experience in any of that. And it ended up being the best blessing for me because no one taught me or told me how to do it. So it was guaranteed that it would be done differently.
Interesting.
And that was, you know, it guaranteed that it would be creative and different and unique. So no, neither my partner and I or I had any background in – I mean, we couldn't even make a paper airplane.
Right.
And we're getting this, and we didn't have money to buy a plane. So.
And you weren't a pilot either, I'm assuming.
No.
Okay.
But we had an idea.
And you had a passion for it.
We had an idea. And intuitively, I think we both knew it would work because we knew if we wanted to use this product that probably a lot of people would want to use it, and how could we make it more affordable and bring it to the masses.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do? Tell me the problem and then what the solution was you guys
created. Well, the problem was there was only three ways to fly privately at the time. You could buy your own airplane, which is incredibly
expensive.
It takes out 99.9% of the world. You could buy a fraction of a plane, which is like a timeshare, which is also very expensive, and it's a long commitment.
Mm.
And that's not – we don't want to put a couple of $1 million in for multiple years. We wanted to take like 3 trips a year with our friends to golf.
Yeah.
Or you could charter a plane. And there's all kinds of questions about like, well, who owns the plane? Who's flying the plane? What if the plane doesn't show up? You know, inconsistencies. So we were like, if we could just offer a 25-hour solution with none of the responsibilities of owning your own plane. You don't have to manage it. You don't have to schedule it. You just like call on demand. It shows up. And you prepay for it and like just work off the hours. It will work.
It's like the Uber for planes.
Yeah. But there was one problem.
What?
We didn't have any planes.
Okay.
So we once we had the idea and we had it all kind of baked, we had to go find someone that could lend us a fleet of airplanes.
Right. How many did you want to start with?
Well, we sat next to each other like you and I are doing. And my partner asked me, how many people do you think would buy this that you know? And I said, I could probably sell 15. He said, all right, put me down for 15. I said, we need enough to hold 30 people.
Wow.
And we went to NetJets, which is owned by Warren Buffett. And Berkshire, and with this idea.
Are they based out of Columbus?
Yeah.
Whenever I fly in, I see big NetJets on. Gotcha. Yeah.
And had this meeting to pitch this idea that was going to change my life, and they threw us out in about 10 minutes.
Why?
I think the direct quote is, sounds cool. If you guys think I'm giving two 27-year-olds my fleet of airplanes, it's not happening.
You're out of your mind. Yeah.
And but his partner came out after the meeting and said, that was a great meeting. I said, what are you talking about? We got thrown out in 12 minutes. He said, Rich Santulli, the CEO, doesn't give anyone 12 minutes. And I said, if you guys kind of just do this, change this, do this.
Come back and let's
try it again. So we did. But instead of coming back with a deck, we brought in our own focus group. We literally just lined up like 8 chairs of athletes, entertainers, agents,
people
lawyers.
Who could afford it.
Right. And one by one, they stood up and explained why they wouldn't buy their own plane, why they wouldn't buy a NetJet fraction.
Wow.
And why they would buy this card.
Wow.
And we got a deal. And then a year later, you know, I think we had more customers than NetJet.
No way. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's brilliant that you brought people in, that you were able to enroll your friends into coming in and supporting you.
Yeah. No, it was,
wow.
It was great.
And they were all on board because they wanted to use the product, it sounds
yeah.
like.
Yeah. No, I mean,
they
want to
fly private.
Yes.
They don't want to buy first class and wait in line for an hour or two or whatever, right?
Right.
Or pay millions. Interesting.
So it worked out.
Amazing.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
That's really cool. And how long did you have that company for until you
we had it in 01? We ramped it up to $5 billion in sales and sold it in 09 to Berkshire.
Wow, amazing. Congratulations, that's big.
That's
I
good.
Love it. Okay, and so during that time then you got connected with Zico, right?
Yeah, so in 2006, I decided to raise money for a bunch of charities that were important to me. And I didn't want to do it the way, you know, at the time I was going to all these golf dinners for charity and, you know, banquets and all this stuff. And it was just like the same thing. So I decided I was going to run 100 miles to bring awareness and raise money for these charities. And I picked a date on my calendar and said, I'm going to start training today. And during the process, I did a lot of research on like, well, what do you drink?
Right.
And what do you eat if you're going to run for 24 hours?
Yeah, yeah.
And I stumbled upon coconut water. Mm. And I became literally like the human guinea pig for coconut water. And I ended up finishing the race and I didn't cramp. And I was like, wow, this is the fountain of youth. Like when other people discover what I just discovered, you know, to like a regular guy that's not a great athlete and just ran 100 miles, this thing's got some legs to it. So I spent a year. I went to Jamaica. I traveled to Brazil, tried to figure out like, you know, can I import this? How does the whole beverage game work? And realized that I wasn't wired and I didn't have the energy to start from, you know.
Start from scratch.
Yeah, from scratch. Learn the ropes. Like the category was starting to move too fast.
Yeah.
And the learning curve would be too great for me.
Yeah.
And my energy level wasn't there at this point in my life. So I ended up partnering with a guy named Mark Rampolas, a rock star, who founded Zico. And
so he already had the brand.
He had the brand.
He
had the brand. They were doing about, you know, $4 or $5 million in sales.
Yeah.
And we went to Coca-Cola. I had gone to Coca-Cola with this idea originally to see if they would kind of be my NetJets. They could provide the back office stuff. Anyway, we did a 3-way partnership. Me, my company, which was the 100 Mile Group, Zico, and Coca-Cola, 3-way partnership. And then we sold, you know, grew it, sold it 3 years later to Coke.
To Coke. Amazing. It's unbelievable, man.
Yeah, it was good. And it was, you know, it was a great product at the right time. And I really believed in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark did a great job with the company.
It's a great product, yeah. I mean, there's so many competitors now. There's so many coconut brands.
Yeah, I think that is like 250 different beverages that use coconut.
Oh my gosh,
something.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
unbelievable. It tastes so good, though. Like you said, it's not a youth, right? So tell me, how did the whole "I want to own an NBA team come about then? How does this?
Again, like, wasn't planned. I live in Atlanta. I'm a season ticket holder, huge basketball fan. I had the past experience having, you know, done a lot of these songs for the NBA teams in my past life, and which ultimately became more like ad campaigns and theme and real slogans and way more than just a theme song. So I had a little bit of background in kind of how game operations work and, you know, what you do at a timeout and how the in-arena operations work. But I'm a big fan. I was season ticket holder at the Hawks, and I was a consultant to the Hawks for about a year prior to this. And when the team became for sale, I fell so in love with the product, the player, the players, the coaching staff, the employees, the brand, the community, that I just put my hand up really in a big way and said, I want to be involved. And, and surprisingly, not a lot of people in Atlanta did. And, I was just lucky enough to hook up with a small group of friends, and we got it.
Wow. Is it three of you or is it?
Well, there were four. We started out with, there were four of us, and now there's about, I think there's about 14, total owners.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So you like raised a fund essentially, and there's like a few that started. Gotcha. And your wife's one of them, right?
Yep.
And how did that come about? Were you guys connected?
My wife and I?
Yeah.
She was a customer at Marquee Jet.
Okay.
And she came to a customer appreciation event, and we became friendly. And, you know, sort of like how I got my record deal, I had to kind of break through the clutter. So before I ran the 100 miles, I called up her office. She's an entrepreneur. She has a company called Spanx, which is women's shapewear.
It's huge, right?
Yeah. And I called her PR person and asked if she would connect me to Sarah, and they said no. And I said, well, could you tell her that I want to run – I'm running this 100-mile race, and I want to do it in Spanx to get some publicity for her brand if she's interested. She'll make a donation. And I married her a year later.
Amazing. So did she make the donation or no?
No, but we got married.
Exactly. That's cool.
Better than a donation.
So did she hear about it before you went in the race or after you did it?
Before. She her PR person said, as she would tell the story, Sarah, another lunatic's on the phone. This time it's someone saying he wants to run 100 miles in a pair of Spanx. And
that caught her attention.
Yeah, I mean, she's married to
enough. Yeah, gotcha. Very cool. So did you guys connect before the race, though, or no?
Yeah, we were friendly. We became friendly. But we really started dating after the race.
Interesting. She was like, a guy loves my brand this much, I'll go out with him, right?
Right.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to talk about the book now. I love your story. I love what you've created. You know, you're like the representation of someone who creates something from nothing with everything you do. And for me, that's really inspiring. And I think it's inspiring for a lot of people that are listening, because most people don't believe they can create something from nothing. And you create big things from nothing, which I think is really cool. And you didn't have like the education for all these things, right? You didn't go to like a school specifically for music or for owning an NBA team or any of these things, right? You just learned as you went, which I think is really cool and admirable. Why the point of having a SEAL live with you? This book's called Living with a SEAL, 31 Days, Training with the Toughest Man on the Planet. And I watched a few videos on this guy. He's a freak. But why did you decide to have him live with you?
On theme, it wasn't planned. Mm. I was at a race in San Diego that I was doing with five friends. It was a 24-hour relay race, where we each turns running a leg of the race.
Is this San Diego to LA and back or something?
No, it was actually a 24-hour race on a one-mile unlit, dark parking lot. And we were doing it just to kind of get out of New York and have fun and whatever. And at the start of the race – and the race was unsupported, which means that you have to completely bring all your own supplies. They'd provide nothing.
Right. And they provide the track, essentially.
A track and, you know, a chip in your shoe to clock your time.
Right.
And, you know, I was coming off Marquee Jet, so our supplies were like loaded. I mean, yeah, like whole food truck. Yeah, like trucks of stuff came up.
And there campers, everything, luxury.
Masseuses and tents.
Acupuncture set up, yeah.
We had like lights under our thing. The guy to my left was running the entire thing alone. And his supplies, he had three supplies.
24 hours?
Yeah, he had three supplies. He had a fold-up chair that he sat in, one bottle of water, and a bag of crackers. That's it.
And, for 24 hours?
Yeah. And he was about 280 pounds and of like muscle. And I'm looking at this guy. I'm like, what the – wow. It made no sense. And at mile seven – so I kept my eye on him during the race. And at mile 70 about, because of his weight.
70?
7-0.
Yeah.
Because of his weight, he had broken all the small bones in both of his feet.
Oh, my gosh.
Because of all the pounding. And because he had only eaten crackers, when he sat down on his folding chair, all the blood that was from the run rushed down, blah, 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 blah. He had basically a kidney failure. He was peeing blood.
Oh, my gosh.
So he was done. And till he wasn't done, I watched him get out of the chair, peeing blood and with all of his broken bones taped up, and run 30 more miles.
No way.
And I was like, who is this guy and what in the world makes him tick? So I Googled him after the race.
Did you say hi to him or connect with him?
No, no. He wasn't a say hi to guy.
Wow.
He was a don't fuck with me guy.
Right.
And so I got his number off of his bib, looked at the race results, Googled him, and learned that he has this like amazing backstory. He was a Navy SEAL. He lost 100 pounds in 60 days before he reported to SEAL, to Buds, to training camp. Mm-hmm. He gained the weight back and then after he graduated, and then lost a bunch of friends in a helicopter crash, and decided to Google the 10 hardest things in the world to do to raise money for the kids of the fallen soldiers, and literally became the best endurance athlete on the planet. He broke the Guinness Book of World Records for most pull-ups in a day. He did 4,030 in 17 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
He's run multiple ultra marathons, won multiple races. I mean, I can't even explain what this guy – so anyway, I cold called him. I'm like, I got to meet this guy. Flew out to meet him. And like 10 minutes into our meeting, I'm like, you know what? All the different buckets of my life would be better if whatever this guy has rubbed off on me. Like whatever made him get out of that chair, I want that in work. I want that at home. I want that in my training. I want that to give that on to my kids, like everything. So I just asked him if he would live with me for a month, if he would move in with me and my family. And 3 days later, he's at my breakfast table.
Wow. Okay. And was there a format, a structure? Because you're a busy guy. You're traveling a lot. You're, you know, probably not at home that much. So what was it like? You know, were you like, I'm going to be at home this whole time?
Right. So the rule was,
comes to you with work, or he just stays at home.
He shadowed me everywhere I went.
Everywhere. 24/7, except for bed.
Everywhere.
He didn't sleep in the same bed.
No, he slept in the room next to us.
Yeah, okay.
Slept in my house.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing he said, the only condition before he moved in was that I had to do anything that he said,
okay,
and that nothing was off limits. And if I didn't do it, he'd leave.
Right.
And,
obviously, with respecting your family and, you know,
nothing
like.
Not really. Okay. No, I mean, it was like he, when he first moved in, he comes into the house and he has a little knapsack for 30 days. If I go away for 30 days, I'm checking two bags.
Yeah.
He has this little like Huck Finn
for 30 days
knapsack
with all his clothes and everything and
his whole life in the bag. And I said to him, his name is David Goggins. So if you're listening and you know him or you want to Google him, I said in the book I referred to him as SEAL, but now, you know, he's out there. So he came to the house and I said to him, you know, hey, here's your room, you know, I'll show you around, make yourself at home, and you know, my home is your home for the next 30 days. And he said, No. He said, I don't have a home. And I said, no, make yourself at home. It's an expression. And he said, I don't operate in expressions.
Wow.
And that was sort of like, okay, let's start. So that was kind of our opening act.
No settling in, no, yeah.
And then we went down to the gym 5 minutes into our 31-day journey. And he said, I want to see how many pull-ups you can do. So I said, all right. So I guess to kind of get a level of like where I was at. And I am not a strong guy. So I did maybe 8 pull-ups. Yeah. And then I dropped down. And he said, all right, wait 30 seconds and do it again. So I waited 30 seconds, got back up on the bar. I did like 6. He said, all right, one more time. Mm-hmm. And now like I'm starting to feel it. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't think I can even get back up on the bar. And I get 3, but 3 like, you know, kicking,
yeah,
getting
yeah.
my chin over, like whatever I could do to get over the bar. So I said, all right, what's next? He said, what's next is we're going to stay here till you do 100 more.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said,
you're doing one at a time, essentially.
Yeah, and I'm like, come on, man. Like that's great on paper, but I physically can't do 100 more. And that was our start of many lessons that I learned, because I ended up doing it one at a time. And what he taught me was that so many of our limitations are self-imposed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we set something up in our brain. We program our brain one way, and that's our limit. And until we can get past that and see what we're really made of and like get uncomfortable and experience pain, you don't really know what you're capable of.
Yeah.
So that was a really good lesson for me. And every day was a lesson like that.
Wow. So would he wake you up in the middle of the night? Was it, or did you have a boundary where like from 10 to 4, you know, I'm with my wife and dad? Or
he did all kinds of really non-traditional things.
Really? And you just had to say yes.
I said yes.
What about your wife? She was just like on board with it.
She was on board with it.
But he wasn't doing it with the kids or her. They were out of it, right?
He took the kids. At the time, I only had one son. Now I have four kids. And my son was 18 months old. And one day he took us. We went running with a 50-pound weight vest. And it was in the snow. And when we did like for like an hour and a half. And we came back. And I was on the couch wiped out. And he woke me up immediately, said, come on, we're doing it again.
Wow.
And my wife had left, so I was on kind of babysitting duty. So I said, I'd love to, but I have my son. And he said, bring him.
Wow.
And I said, it's 18 degrees out and snowing, and he's 18 months old. I can't bring him. And he said, bring him.
Wow.
So put the vest on and bundled my
son up. Otherwise, he would have walked out and left, right?
Yes. And we did it. And, you know, at first, when he moved in, I was at a great point in my life. You know, I was married. I thought I was operating at a high level. I didn't realize
You've had successful businesses.
But I didn't realize how much more I had in me. And I was in a routine. You know, like all of us, you know, my routine for me, it was have breakfast, go to work, come home with your family, repeat. And it was great. But I wasn't getting better because I couldn't get out of the – I was so comfortable in it.
Yes.
And like to get out of a habit requires really rewiring your brain. And I just couldn't do it at that point. I don't know. I've done it in the past. I just couldn't do it. So I brought him in to really shake things up. But and when I did it, I emailed 30 friends. And I said, guys, the workouts I'm doing are so insane. You got to check it out. And they started sharing it and it caught on. But what I realized was it was the mental side of it. The what is behind this guy? What is driving him? Where does this come from? How do I get it? How do I get to be more mentally tough? How do I get to be more consistently disciplined? And that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to share more of him than just like, oh, we ran 9 miles and then he woke me up and we ran 7 miles and I did this many pull-ups. Like, you know, that comes and goes. I mean, you've had
– anyone can do the workouts, but it's the mindset behind it, yeah.
Right. I wanted Obi-Wan Kenobi on my shoulder all the time.
Wow. So what would you think were the top three lessons that you learned from those 30 days? 31 days, sorry.
Well, you know, he has this thing called the 40% rule, which is basically when your brain tells you you're done, you're really only 40% done.
Oh my gosh.
But the reality is we're all wired. So the first time we experience pain or discomfort, our brain sends a signal and taps you on the shoulder because it doesn't want you to get hurt.
Yeah.
And but if you ignore that tap on your shoulder and keep going, you can do so much more.
Sure.
So that was a really good lesson. And I kind of learned that with the pull-ups.
But when's the limit the limit? Like once you do that, you know, 60% more or 40% more.
You got to find out.
You keep going until you break an arm or until you go to the hospital or.
It depends on who you are.
Right.
I think.
Did you ever hit that limit where you had to go to the hospital?
I hit the limit where I physically could not go on. Like we were doing push-ups one day and I just physically couldn't get up. You know, like do another one. Like I just couldn't do another. My mind wanted to do another one. I just felt like I just couldn't do it.
Yes.
But,
could he kind of read your energy and was like, okay, now's enough.
Well, we went into the steam room once because some of it was just psychological stuff. So we went in the steam room one day and he set the, maxed out on the steam to the highest temperature.
Right.
It was like 130, but it felt like it was 180 because it was had to be a broken, you know, it was definitely hotter than 130.
It was hot. How long are we in there for?
Well, he said we're going to go in for 30 minutes with one glass of water. And at about 19 minutes, he's like in the corner, like literally like whistling to himself.
Shut up.
And I'm like, I said to him, like, Goggins, I got to get out of here. He's like, we got 11 more minutes. I'm like, I got to get out of here. And before he could answer, I opened up the door and he came out and he grabbed me. He goes, get the back in.
Wow.
And then he looked at me. He's like, you don't look so good. I'm like, man, I don't feel so good. And I was kind of drifting into La La Land.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, we're boarding. I'm like, we're boarding?
Aborting?
We're boarding? Abort!
So he didn't put you back in.
He didn't put me back in.
So he kind of saw the limit.
he saw the limit. He also watched me sit in that chair for about 3 hours
afterwards to recover. Yeah. Drinking coconut water.
Yeah. I mean, we had just ran. You know, I was so out of whack from everything we were doing. I wasn't sleeping. And then we went into this heat. I was dehydrated already. The steam, it was like,
oh,
it was
my
gross.
Gosh.
It was just, I couldn't breathe. It was just,
plus you're also mentally, I'm assuming you didn't put you didn't put your life on pause during this.
I was working full time.
Working full time on multiple businesses, right?
12-hour day, like full.
Then you're full time with your son, right? And then your wife. So it's not like you're just neglecting
and traveling,
them.
And at the time and building a house. It was crazy, but what one lesson that he taught me was so important is, you know, I was able to take on all that he was putting on my plate, and do more without getting rid of anything. Because what I did was, he basically after a week looked at my life. He was like a life coach in a weird way,
right?
And said to me, you know, I was filling up my calendar with so much non-essential stuff.
Yes, non-productive things.
Because I felt obligated to say yes to lunch meetings. Yes. Will you meet this guy for 15 minutes? Will you take this call? And I just didn't want to be like, oh, Jesse's an asshole. He won't take this meeting. So I would just do it. And I realized, like, I was losing control of my own time.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I lost control of my own time. So I just said – I started saying no to everything, canceling everything that wasn't going to really – that I didn't need to do.
Right.
That was other people putting demands on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I really started focusing on me. I mean, I think so much of business is a reflection of you. And so many of us don't invest in ourselves.
Yes.
So I drew a little pie chart of my time, of how I want to spend my time. And in my 24 hours, I broke it up into four different sections. And I make sure that every day I have 3 hours for me. So I can, you know, because I think it's just so important that we put ourselves first.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't. So many of us don't. And you get all these arrows shot at you every day, bills, problems, friends need this, work, the plumber has to come because this is broken. This thing won't start. It's like, psh, 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 you're always dodging arrows.
Right.
There's no way around that. But if you don't take the 3 hours to at least separate yourself from the constant attack of arrows.
You're crazy. Yeah.
Bonkers.
Yeah.
So, you know,
or you're going to get out of shape, or you're going to feel like you don't have any self-worth or something.
Right.
Interesting. So what are you doing those 3 hours?
It's my time. So it could be nothing and watch TV.
Uh-huh.
It could be exercise for 2 hours, get in a sauna and read the paper. It could be read a book. It could be returning. It's however I want to do it, but it's my time that I control.
Do you schedule that every day? Is it broken up an hour here, an hour there? Is it at night?
It's 3 hours together. For me, I mean, I'm able to do that. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times I'll kill two birds with one stone.
No one else is around. It's just you alone, or is it your friends?
No one else is controlling my time.
So you can have friends in that time with you working out or doing whatever.
Yes. But I'm not going and doing something I don't want to do.
It's all your
decisions. Not taking calls unless it's an emergency. I'm shut down.
Wow.
I'm shut down. Now, sometimes if I'm training for something or I want to, I'll say, you know what, I'm going to schedule all my calls during those 3 hours and I'll go for a run or a walk and I'll take them with me, or I'll listen to a podcast during that. So I'm like, all right, you know what, I'm going to go for a 3 hour walk, let's just say.
Right, right.
And then I'll knock it all out.
Sure, sure. Interesting. Okay. So what are the other three sections of the day? You said
sleep, family, work.
Sleep, family, work. And how much sleep do you get?
Six or seven.
Okay.
And then the rest depends on, I mean, for me, my bucket's a little, my bucket used to be 10 hours of work and 2-3 hours of family and 7 hours and three, you know, it's amazing how much you can do in 24 hours. Think about it. Get 7 hours of sleep, take 3 hours for yourself is 10, and work a full day, 8 hours. You have 6 hours left of family time.
Yeah.
And like that's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time.
So you could, I mean, just
think
about it.
You've already caught up on everything in an hour.
No, but my point is, and that's what I got out of this guy living with me, 24 hours is a long time, and we maximized the time. I would get home at 11 o'clock some nights, and we would spend an hour from 11 to 12 working out if we didn't do it or we had to get more in. Every minute was maximized. It wasn't like we were just going to go and be like, you know what, let's just go, you know, whatever. No, it was all about being productive with my own time.
Yeah.
Too.
You know, you talked about habits and routines. What would you say is, you know, and that you kind of got complacent with your routines, or they kind of held you back at a certain level, right? You weren't able to break through a certain level. I talk about habits and routines and about how important they are on this podcast a lot. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that they're important, but every few months or year, you've got to switch it up. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, I don't want to go against your
no, it's okay. I'm curious.
Your wisdom of this. But I think there are times where I would disagree and say that habits and routines are great. They are. But they also could be a rut.
Sure.
And, you know, and once you get to a place where they are a rut and you're not getting better,
that's when you gotta, yeah,
there's all kinds of, you know, studies on that. Now, it's all that also changing it up and changing up your habit also leads a little bit to means getting uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
Breaking a habit requires a lot. So if you get in a habit, to get out of that habit requires rewiring your brain. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact. And that's hard to do, you know? And it's no different than – it's just a very hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to that place, I couldn't get out of that rut because I was so deep in my habit. I'd been doing the same run, the same this, and that was my day. I had to work out. I had to run in the morning. I went to work. I mean, just couldn't get out of it. So for me, it ended up being a rut, and I had to mix it up.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you choose your wife? I'm curious about this. Why is your wife your wife?
Well, we both got married. We were both older when we got married. I got married at 40. My wife was 37 when we got married. So it was, you know, for me, the 20s and 30s were fun, super fun. And that's where I was in my life. My head was around fun, work. I had to work at nights. Like, nights were really important to me.
Yeah.
I just wasn't ready. And, you know, there's only three scenarios. Right girl, right time. That's the one.
Uh-huh.
Right girl, wrong time. That doesn't work. And wrong girl, right turn, right time. It doesn't work. So she was right girl, right time.
Interesting. Why was she the right girl for you?
She still is. She's independent, and which I needed. She, you know, she had her own career. She allowed me to have a long leash and freedom to do the things that I like, but we still checked in with each other. Mm-hmm. Still check in with each other. Values were the same. You know, all the stuff that, you know, if you check sure, 8 out of the 10 boxes, it's probably a fit.
That's great. And what's the biggest lesson you've learned about yourself through her lens or being married with her? What has she taught you?
Well, you go through different chapters.
Sure.
So marriage for us before we had kids was one chapter. Marriage with a child was another. Marriage with four is another.
Yeah.
But listen, you know, for me and for her, you make a commitment. You're in a team. And what I love about marriage is, like, no matter what happens, you got to hug and make up and move on. You know what I mean? Like, when you're dating, it's like, oh, you know what? It's not going to work out. When you're married, you got to sort it out, mm-hmm, and figure it out. And, you know, that's hard, but it's also fun.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. How does she inspire you?
You'll see, Lewis.
I know. I'm waiting. How does she inspire
you? If you want to get on the couch right now, I'm happy to walk you through some stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. You could be my SEAL. how does she inspire you to break through your limits on a consistent basis, or does she?
Well, she's an entrepreneur that's made her living putting herself out there. So she's always, you know, not been scared to fail, not been scared to take a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And she's lived her life on the edge.
Right.
So she allows me to have the same mentality and encourages me to do stuff like that. So I was telling you before we started recording that about a month ago, I invited the 10 of the most influential artists, music artists in my life that really changed the trajectory of my life when I was growing up and took me on a whole different course to my house for dinner. And they all came. And I told my wife, I said, Sarah, next Friday, you might want to circle your calendar. We're having 10 guests come from, you know, some from the Bronx, some from Queens. And, you know, she knows that's in my DNA. And I know that stuff like that is in her DNA.
Sure. And she accepts you for that, it sounds like.
Nothing she does will surprise me. And I don't think anything I do will surprise her.
Right. I gotcha. I like it. What's next for you? You've had the SEAL live with you. You've had these experiences. You've been talking about this for a while now and press and everything like that. When do you know? Let me ask you, what's next for you? And how does someone know when they're in a rut and how do they get to get out of it? And how are you going to get out of the next rut you're in? Because it's going to happen, it sounds like, for all of us.
Right. So for me, you know, I love – it's one thing to I love reading about inspiration and motivation, and you know, you do it all day long. You encourage people, you motivate people, but it's a completely different thing to live with inspiration and motivation. And I love this because I got so much more out of it than just reading a book.
Right.
That I'm going to continue to do a series of books where I live with interesting people.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So
that's brilliant.
You know, and I have all kinds of ideas and thoughts around what will be next.
Hmm.
But
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. So
wow,
it'll be like a kind of living with series.
I think it's brilliant because this is nothing compared to what you're doing. But I, growing up, I was, you know, my dad had 7 different exchange students live with us for 6 months at a time from all over the world. So these 17 and 18 year old seniors came to learn English and go to high school in my hometown. And I had all these older brothers and sisters that I learned culture, language, food, everything from, that I feel like developed me as a, you know, a different human being than my peers, right? And where I had these extra skills and perspective. So I think it's really cool that you're going to be attracting, I'm assuming, the top people in the world at what they do to live with you and continue to develop. So I think I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, no, I'm excited.
I wish I had that idea.
That's another thing I know I married the right woman, because she's allowing these people to come into our house.
Amazing. Now, has anyone else tried to hire him to have him live with him or them for 30 days? Or
Yes.
It's like his job now to like go in and reprogram homes, right?
You know, we had the right chemistry between us. He came from a completely different background, life than I did. We're totally different, black, white. You know, his childhood was tough. Mine was, you know, comfortable. It was just like these two worlds colliding were unbelievable and would be very difficult for a lot of people, I think.
Yes.
And for us, it, you know, personality wise and just where we were, it worked out. So I think we'd have a hard time
for the other people,
both sides, for him and for other families.
Sure, sure.
And I don't think he wants to do that. I mean,
yeah. What was it like the day after he left?
It was quiet and sad. Well, first of all, he lived with me for 31 days, shadowed me, went to every meal, every meeting, everywhere, every trip, everything. He left me a note. Hey, man, thanks.
No goodbye?
No.
No hug?
No. He left. Wow. Like as soon as that clock hit the 12 o'clock, he was out.
I'm assuming you hired him, so you paid him for the time, right? I'm assuming there was like –
Yeah, well, you know, he never asked me for money.
Really?
Which was very – pretty unbelievable. I did pay him.
Right.
But he never – we didn't negotiate like – He was like, I'll come live with you. And I was like, I'm going to compensate you. And he was like,
okay,
whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
So that was – it was sad, you know. And I was tired. I was tired.
From all the training. And
yeah. So I was kind of glad that it was done but kind of sad that he left.
Nice.
Like if he could have just hung out and we could have watched ESPN for a week, that would have been cool.
Right.
But if he had to stay another week with the push-ups –
You're
probably
fine
time
that
he left.
Gotcha. So now how much of this can you consistently do yourself? Obviously, you're not doing the extreme workouts every single day the way he did it, I'm assuming. But how much of what you learned are you still applying on a daily basis? How much do you say, you know what, there's still 20 more percent I can do.
Yeah.
Let me actually push it. Or are you just like, well, I know it's available for me, but I'm not going to do it.
Well, a lot of the physical stuff, you know, I wasn't able to keep it up without him because it was just too much for me, but it was the mental stuff that has stayed with me. And that's really what I wanted. So I get his little voice on my shoulder all the time. If I don't want to do something, if it's cold, you know, listen, if we could all get motivated through our conversation, we could tell, oh, everyone who's listening, we're going to run a 10K tomorrow and get everyone pumped up and they're fired up. We play Rocky in the background. People are all jacked up. And then we said, we're going to start tomorrow morning. And tomorrow morning, you wake up and it's dark, it's windy, it's wet, cold out.
Yeah.
That motivation goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that mental toughness that says, you know what? I don't care that it's dark, wet, windy, cold. I'm going to go anyway. That's what I kept with me.
Yeah.
And in training and in work, you know, I get deal fatigue. I get I don't, you know, you lose motivation. You go through peaks and valleys.
Yeah.
We all do. It's that mental toughness that, you know, hopefully can push you through it. And it goes to like your last question was, you know, how do you identify you're in a rut or you're in a, you know, you're not improving. You know, I think you identify that you're in a rut when you want to get better and you're not, you know, and it's easy to fall into habit. It's so easy.
Yeah. Comfortable habit that's not moving you forward.
Listen, yes. I've been in brands. I've launched brands that I thought were great ideas, but required breaking a habit. And that is super difficult.
Yeah.
And coconut water is one. You're asking someone to go and say, stop drinking what you're drinking today. Put down your whatever you're drinking.
Completely change your habit.
Right. Yep. And go try this. Oh, and then do it again next week. And then buy it again the week after.
Yeah.
And then go get another person to do that.
It's hard.
Come on, man.
It's hard. It's got to be a great product for that to happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's a non-negotiable for you every single day? What's a habit that is a must-do every day for you?
For 25 years, it was running. Maybe not every day, but, you know.
Pretty close
to every single day.
A couple miles.
A non-negotiable for me is I only eat fruit until noon. Like, so if you
then
said
you don't eat fruit after noon.
I do, but I don't eat anything other than fruit until noon for 27 years.
Oh, you so only eat fruit
I
until
only
noon.
Eat fruit until noon.
And then afternoon, you'll still eat fruit.
If you said to me, Jess, tomorrow, let's get up and let's go have pancakes.
Right. Or eggs and sausage.
Right. I would say, Lewis, I would love to, but I'm going to have a banana.
Right.
Right.
Why is that?
I read a book called Fit for Life in 1991. And one of the principles of the book was to only eat fruit until noon because digestion requires so much energy.
It does.
You eat a big meal or you eat something that's hard to digest, you get tired. Thanksgiving, you're tired. Have a steak and potatoes, you're usually tired. Lions eat a lot of meat, big meals, they sleep all day. But fruit digests in 20 minutes and is the only thing that doesn't digest in your stomach. It bypasses your stomach.
Wow.
Digests in your small intestines, but is loaded in nutrients. Perfect sugar balance with your brain and helps with elimination. So I'm not a scientist. I'm not a food nutritionist. I don't know. I'm not any of that. But I tried it for 10 days,
it worked.
The book said. And here I am 27 years later, and I ran 100 miles, and it's never changed.
Wow.
And I've missed probably 3 days of work.
Wow.
27 years. So
amazing. I love that. Are there any other non-negotiables, or is that?
I mean, I got a little nutty. Stuff, yeah, I got some non-negotiables.
We'll talk about it afterwards. Gotcha. final few questions for you. What? Why are you so motivated to continue doing what you're doing? I mean, you've built so many amazing businesses. You've tried all these things. You're married to an incredible woman. You've got kids. Why do you keep moving forward? Why do you want to keep creating books, building businesses? What's the drive for you?
I mean, I think it's two things. One is I'm a big believer in building life resumes and creating memories. And, last year, if I said to you, name five things that happened last year, it would take you a long time to probably think of five things that you really remember. And I bet the five are either the most wild or hardest, or those are usually the most memorable. And those are the things that make you feel the most alive. So I love creating life memories, and challenges are the more challenging, the more memorable, and the more alive you feel. And the second thing is, I don't believe in, finish lines, to the sense that I believe in one day celebrations, like check the box and move on. Run a marathon. I'm not like, that's great. Let's celebrate it that night. Let's show everyone our medal, but let's not sit there and think about it for 6 months that we ran a marathon. Mm-hmm. Like, that's great. We did it. What's next? So I've never been someone that if you didn't bring up Marquee Jet or Zico, it's not even on my mind.
Right.
It's in the past.
Right.
I mean, subconsciously it lives in me and it's part of my journey. But it's like, I'm thinking about what can I do next?
Yeah.
You
want to keep creating.
Yeah. I mean, it's just you did it.
I love it.
It's like moving back to your old neighborhood.
Yeah. It's great. What are you most grateful for in your life recently?
I mean, knock on wood, man, 4 healthy kids. Without question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. This is a question I like to ask at the end for everyone. It's many, many years from now, and it's the last day for you. And let's say that the people you love are there, but every book you've written, all the businesses you've ever created have been erased from time, and all the interviews you've ever done are gone. No one has access to the information you put out there. And your friends and family say you've got a piece of paper and a pen, and you get to write down 3 truths, the 3 things that you know to be true about all your life memories that you've created and your experiences that you pass on to us for us to use as a guide for the rest of our lives. What would you say are the 3 truths for you?
I would just say there's one.
One truth.
I would just say, just to be – if I was telling my kids like on my deathbed, I would just say to be good to people. I mean, at the end of the day, really, what else is there other than treating people well? And, you know, one of the best things about success is you get to spoil your friends and family. And that's the most rewarding thing. It's not that you can go and get a bigger house or, you know, it's that you can share things with your family and friends, vacations, game, you know, sporting events, big moments, fly them in, and do stuff with the people that you really want to do it with. I mean, and it's hard to say, like, live an honorable life and don't lie. And, you know, we all try to do that stuff. And you do it to the best of your ability. And obviously there's going to be little exaggerations here and there and this and that. But at the end of the day, for me, it's just, you know, I've made my living and my life when I was in my 20s, treating everybody exactly the same from doorman to whatever, because in my 30s, those same people, and I had no idea that this was the case in my 20s, but in my 30s, all those people that I've been nice to, that I crossed paths, you know, met or whatever, were in positions of power. So many of them went on to be in positions of power. And, like, you know, people genuinely want to help people if they were nice and good to them and have a good taste or feeling about them. If the energy is good between us, you know, you're going to want to help me, I'm going to help you down the road with nothing in return. And I found in my 30s that that was the case, that people wanted to genuinely, if I picked up the phone and I had done something or we had a relationship, that I could get something moved forward because of that.
Yeah.
Whereas other people could have been an asshole.
Right.
You know what I mean? Just because you're an asshole and you might not have that same thing. So, you know, and I try to do the same thing, you know, with everybody.
Right.
Turning call, you know, everything.
Sure. I love that. One final question before I ask. I want to acknowledge you, Jesse, for your creative spirit and your nature that you have and your consistent commitment to redefining who you want to be and the life you want to live. I think it's inspiring to see your whole journey of what you created in the music world and the jet world and everything. You've come with a fresh perspective.
Thank you.
And I think that's really inspiring for me to know that people like you are out there and you're changing the world with each new life memory that you create. So
appreciate
I want to acknowledge
it.
You for that. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm excited about your book. I want to make sure everyone gets this. It's called Living with a Seal. Make sure to check it out. I'll have it all linked up here in a second, tell you guys where to go. But the final question is, what's your definition of greatness?
Oh, man. Saving that one for the last one. Well, they say that the definition of success is if you're adult kids still want to hang out with you, you know, as they get older. You know, anything that you ask me around greatness, because the hardest challenge is being, and you'll find this out, hopefully, is being do you have kids?
No.
Okay.
Not
is
yet.
Being a parent. It's just so difficult, and it doesn't come with a manual.
Yeah.
So for me, the greatness is if you're, you know, centers around your family.
I love it.
And, you know, how you can help people. Yeah. Everyone has, you know, the ability to do great things at work. There's so much opportunity in this country. We're so lucky to be born in this country where you have nothing but opportunity.
Yeah.
And you see it every day.
Yeah.
And you don't even need a high school or college degree to be a billionaire in today's world. But you got to do a lot of things right and great to be a great parent.
That's powerful. Jesse Itzler, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. There you have it, my friends. Thank you again so much for being here on episode 300. So pumped on where we've come together as a community and the greatness community to get to 300. A lot of you have supported by listening, by sharing, by promoting, by just being involved, by buying the book, by buying the School of Greatness Academy, by being in the community. And I appreciate you guys so very much for your support along the way. So many of you have also sent me suggestions for guests that you would like to have on. And we're getting bigger and bigger influencers and billionaires and celebrities and top athletes and scientists and doctors in the world. And that's my goal, to get the top 1% in their industry to come on and share their secrets and their information on how to be great and what that means and lessons. So if you have a good friend who's in that category, who's on the top 1% of their industry, a mainstream name, someone who's really doing great things in the world, email lewis@schoolofgreatness.com with, in the headline, interview request or interview suggestion. And only do that if you actually have a connection to that person or that person's team, and you could make that intro if I think the person would be great for the show. So don't just tell me, hey, get Obama on the show, and then not have an intro to Obama, right? Give me an intro if you can. That way I don't have to run around and try to make the work happen myself if I don't have that connection. So let me know by sending an email to lewis@schoolofgreatness.com. If you know someone who'd be great for the show at the top 1% of their industry, their field, someone who's doing big things in the world, and send interview request or suggestion, and then let me know who it is and if you have the intro. I appreciate you guys so very much. If you are here for the first time, please leave a review over on iTunes. We're almost at 1,000 reviews, actually. So help me get to 1,000 five-star reviews. It's been amazing to see all the feedback and comments that come through on iTunes. So if you go to itunes.com/schoolofgreatness, you can do that there. Or just if you're on your iPhone right now, on your iPhone app, the podcast app, just tap on leave a review right on your phone. And you can let me know what you think, and I'll check out your thoughts there. I appreciate you guys so very much. We've got some big things ahead. But in the meantime, you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.
At Metro, get an iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system for $99.99. Take amazing pictures and share them instantly. And don't put up with life's yada yada.
Yada yada.
Like photo bombers. Zoom, crop out,
yada yada,
and bye.
You don't take yada yada in life, don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Get iPhone 12 with 5G with no activation fees and nada yada yada. Only at Metro by T-Mobile. Switch to Metro, bring your ID. This offer isn't available for customers currently at T-Mobile or that have been with Metro in the past 180 days.